How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Radio, Tuesday night, July 20th, 2010, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com, joined, as always, by Dave Meltzer here to talk about Raw, the SummerSlam main events. We've got two main events already for the big show of the summer. And, Dave, how you doing tonight?
Doing good. How are you?
Not too bad. The big match is coming up for SummerSlam so far. We've got Sheamus versus Randy Orton for the WWE title, which was made in the opener on Raw this evening. And we've also got a 7-on-7 tag with John Cena, Bret Hart, Chris Jericho, Edge, Truth, Morrison, and yes, the great Khali. Babyface and heels teaming up to take on the Nexus in the SummerSlam, presumably main event. And I thought they did a very good job tonight in building up SummerSlam and having this story make at least a semblance of sense.
Yeah, I thought tonight was a really good show. The 7-on-7, I mean, we're finally getting that match, and, you know, they've held it off, and, a lot of things that were planned for SummerSlam obviously fell through. I think Orton probably would have been in the 7-on-7 match, but Triple H, you know, as out of, you know, because it was, you know, obviously going to be Triple H and Sheamus as the, the championship match, and that's out of the picture with Triple H with the torn biceps. And I am presuming that Steamboat was going to be in that match as well, and obviously that's not happening, so they got Bret in, which, I mean, you know, they're all, you know, it's a real, that's a real weird one, but, you know, they're going to be, I mean, I think now more than ever, they're going to be so ridiculously safe, so I'm not really worried about it or anything. I mean, if he was, like, in a real wrestling match, I would kind of be kind of scared, actually, but I can't imagine, you know, them being anything but the safest possible after what happened with Steamboat. Because Arn and Malenko both hurt their necks in that attack beside, you know, legitimately. I mean, not seriously, but, you know, they both came in with it. You know, they're both banged up anyway. And then Steamboat, you know, was hurt real bad. And so, you know, they're going to, you know, I think that they're going to be very protective of Bret in that match. But it's good because I think that his name being there kind of gives it a little extra special feel and everything. And Cena's been, you know, I like the way they did the show tonight in a lot of ways. You know, kind of getting Sheamus out of the picture when they put him in the picture the week before, which kind of made not that much sense that they put him in the picture, just, you know, had him run away, and now he's already out of the picture again, but, you know, but whatever.
This may not be possible at all, and I don't know, I mean, he's still in the hospital, so, you know, we don't know what the status is of Ricky Steamboat, but I mean, if you did a 7-on-7 match, broke down into a big 14-man brawl, maybe Cena was in the middle of the ring and Justin Gabriel went up top for the 450, and you had Steamboat walk down and trip up Gabriel leading to the finish. That would certainly tie into storylines, and he wouldn't have to do pretty much absolutely anything.
Yeah, I could see that as a possibility.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, if all it was a trip, he could do it, I'm sure. You know, that's not that big of a deal.
No.
You know, they may not, but it would make sense given the storyline.
I was also watching the show. Let's talk about it here because I want to talk about the opener and something that was mentioned and then blown off completely. And anyway, opened up with Edge, Orton, and Jericho with the winner getting Sheamus at SummerSlam. And it started out as, when this match first started, I thought, geez, Edge, Orton, and Jericho, some fresh faces here fighting for a title at SummerSlam. And ended up, they had like a pay-per-view quality match. They had a hell of a match here on free TV and ended up with Orton hitting the RKO on both guys, pinning Edge. Hell of a match. So Orton gets the title shot against Sheamus. And then afterwards, they did the big angle where Edge called out Jericho. He said this had gone on too long between them, talked about 11 years of pain and suffering, how it needed to end forever. And
that was kind of weird.
Well, that's what I'm getting to here. Both guys ended up cutting a promo on each other and talked about how they would be the guy that if they snapped their fingers, Nexus would come out and beat up the other guy. And Nexus, of course, ended up coming out. And first they killed Edge, And then Jericho put Edge in the walls, and then he realized these guys were all looking at him, and then they killed Jericho. And, of course, that led to the angle at the end of the show where Edge and Jericho both have joined Cena's team. But when this first started, I thought, huh, looks like they may be having the Jericho-Edge Loser Leaves Town match at SummerSlam here. And Jericho's contract, of course, up in September. And when the show was over and I look back on it, all I could think was, I wonder if Jericho is going to screw his own team. And then you lead to Jericho and Edge Loser Leaves Town at the September pay-per-view.
Possibility.
They certainly were hinting that there was something going to happen here between these two guys.
It certainly was building like that they were going to do a Loser Leaves Town match.
Yeah.
And, I could very much see that happening, and that would be a guy, I could very much see that happening if Jericho chooses to leave in September, and it's not, I don't know that it's a lock that he's leaving. I know people in the company for months have talked about it as a strong possibility, and we saw those concert dates in the UK, but, he could take 2 weeks off. It's not against you can do that. Guys are allowed to go on vacations, pre-planned months ahead. So I don't know that, or he could take a month off too. Just in between contracts or whatever. So I don't think anything is a lock. I mean, if he's going to go and do a Loser Leaves Town match in WWE, I think that would mean that he really is leaving. If it was TNA, you would just go, it means absolutely nothing.
Well, at least leaving for, 6 months or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you would never say forever. Even if he lets his contract expire and he, goes away, I don't know that that means, I would bet money that he'd come back at some point because, everyone but two or three people in history have done that.
Yeah. So it was a good segment, and I guess the only other thing of note, and this really isn't much of a note, but they've taken Darren Young and they've gotten rid of his absurd hairdo, and he looks more like Carlos Newton now, of all people.
Yeah.
And
isn't that funny that was exactly what I was thinking? I just saw Carlos Newton fight on Saturday night.
That's right, yeah.
But he looks, he's total Carlos Newton hair and actually pretty similar face.
It's, well, yes, and it's a huge improvement for a group that's supposed to be a top heel group. The other hairdo was just too wacky for this crew here.
Yeah, that was a party boy hairdo when he did the party boy gimmick for FCW.
Yeah. We had Josh interviewing Barrett backstage, and I swear to God this is the question Josh asked. He said, NXT was the most powerful group in WWE history, but he had to know if any of them thought that they could compete one-on-one with Mark Henry. That was his actual question. And Barrett blew him off, as he should have. And after he left, Sheamus walked up and said he had a proposal that Barrett would want to hear. And that played in the storyline later. Scene interview. Talked about, he did his sad face promo. And he said he brought all of this upon himself. He refused to shake Barrett's hand. Nobody could stop these men. He saw the writing on the wall. He basically teased, if you can't beat them, join them. And then he walked off sadly. And that was the show-long tease.
He said, if you can't beat him, and then he left.
Yeah.
We were supposed to, The only thing is what would have made this so much more effective is if every single week when something like this happens, you're conditioned that they're swerving you.
Mm-hmm.
I actually believe that absolutely no one really believed that John Cena was going to either join them or beg them to stop. And
yes,
that, in fact, it was going to be at the end he was going to do exactly what he did.
Yeah. Not much of a swerve.
It's an attempted swerve, but everyone expects a swerve. And it's kind of like, I wonder if it would be better to just, go straight forward 80% of the time instead of go swerve 80% of the time, because then when you do the swerve could mean something, as opposed to now where everyone expects the swerve. And if you don't do the swerve, that's the swerve. Kind of like the Jerry McDivitt thing, when you tell the truth, it's like, well, everyone's conditioned for you to lie, so the fact that you told the truth means that you were actually meaning that you were going to lie.
That's quite the idea.
Yeah, he used that in a legal letter once against WCW.
Oh yeah, he did. Yes.
When they told the truth on a certain angle, saying that Vince McMahon would not be coming to a WCW pay-per-view when Eric Bischoff challenged him to a fight.
Yep.
And Eric came out on the show and just goes, Vince McMahon is not coming. And Jerry McDivitt wrote him a letter and goes, that's not fair, because in wrestling, when you do that, that means he is coming. So
Jerry McDivitt is a special man.
Yeah. He was on TV today, this morning.
I heard. Was it Good Morning America?
Good Morning on Good Morning America,
yep,
with Martha Hart.
Yep.
So, which was actually, you know, I mean, they did a five-minute segment on the lawsuit, and she was on, you know, there was nothing that you don't already know if you haven't followed the story, other than, you know, Linda would not be interviewed for the story. She would not go on. Martha Hart did say, you know, did complain about, the things she complained about was that they continued the show. She mentioned it actually twice, that they continued the show after Owen died. And she said that she doesn't really care about what happens in Linda McMahon's campaign. That doesn't interest her at all. But she did think that that decision, you know, tells you something about the decision-making qualities of Linda McMahon, and that's not really fair, only because Linda wasn't even in Kansas City. By the way, real quick, something else. Last night I mentioned that the Sprint Center was the Kemper, and it actually is not. The Sprint Center that they ran the show last night was opened 3 years ago. So the Kemper actually still exists, but it's rarely used when the Sprint Center opened. But anyway, the point that she was saying, you know, she was trying to say that that the decision in 99 when Owen died to go on with a show showed poor leadership quality. And you can make that argument as far as this goes. If Vince McMahon was running for Senate, okay, and not Linda McMahon, you could go in there and look at that and just go, under intense pressure, you could say he made the wrong call. I think he made the wrong call personally, but it's a debatable point. You can certainly say that. I think, you know, most sports, not all, would have stopped the event. Some would have continued. But the point is that Linda McMahon was not in Kansas City, and Linda McMahon did not make that decision. So blaming her for that decision probably isn't fair. Although, to be fair, Martha Hart probably doesn't know that either. And then she, the other thing that she complained about was how the wrestlers did not have health insurance or retirement benefits and things like that. And while Linda would not say anything about it, her campaign said that they're like golfers and tennis players and rock musicians that tour. And they're really not, you know, because of the nature of the way the schedules are. Tennis players can take off anytime they want. They can play as many events as they want. They can make their own schedule. Golfers the same, you know. Rock stars, I think rock stars, I don't know, you could probably work for different promotional companies. I'm not sure exactly how that works, because I really don't know the rock touring business. I don't know, you know, like in different markets, you probably work for, because when the rock stars come in most markets, they usually work with a local rock promoter. It's not a national thing, as far as I know. At least in the old days, that's what it was. So none of those are analogous to pro wrestling, but whatever. And Jerry McDivitt's whole thing was just, this is politically motivated. That's all he had to say. So anyway, that was the piece. It was certainly wasn't good for Linda McMahon, but, you know.
Is these days?
No, not well. I mean, the good thing for Linda McMahon, unfortunately, is the bad thing for the rest of us, which is the economy. The worse the economy gets, the better her chances are. And that's, if she's going to get elected, that's what's going to elect her, is a backlash against the Democrats, a strong backlash come November, because without that, she really doesn't have a prayer to win, even with the money that she's spending. You know, she's still, you know, way far behind in the polls. So, anyway.
Maryse and Eve had a match, and Eve won. DiBiase at ringside on commentary said if Maryse won, she was a new number one contender. So I don't know if that means that Eve is the number one contender now, but regardless.
I think, you know, it's weird because they just did the match, but they don't really have another number one contender until Melina comes back.
Which is going to be soon, probably.
They clearly aren't pushing Gail Kim.
Yeah. So Maryse had her foot on the ropes, and Ted told the ref. The ref didn't care. As they were arguing, Morrison hit the ring and laid out DiBiase, and then Morrison and DiBiase spent a long time glaring at each other, and that was that.
I think that they're probably setting up a rematch with those two, you know, just to, you know, space it out and everything. And it was a good finish to set up a rematch, and, you know, Morrison coming out. I guess Morrison and DiBiase for now will be a television house show program, because obviously they're not going on pay-per-view with it.
Sheamus came out, did a promo, said he'd beaten Cena three times now. Tables match, fatal four-way steel cage. Said Cena was in the past, time to move to the back of the line. Said he went up to Wade Barrett tonight, demanded a truce. And he said a year ago, nobody had heard of him or the Nexus, and now they were the biggest thing on the show. And as he was ranting and raving, out came Miz with the briefcase. And he did the promo basically saying that, I am going to be watching you all the time. I'm going to cash in this briefcase one of these days. Maybe it'll be at SummerSlam, which, by the way, is in L.A., so that would make sense. He said maybe it'll be tonight. And as they were talking, the email appeared. The email showed up, and basically it said that Sheamus was going to be facing Evan Bourne, so Miz might want to stick around, which he did. They had a fun little match. Evan got pinned with the bicycle kick because he was coming back into the ring. Miz hit the ring, hit Sheamus with the briefcase, gave him the skull-crushing finale out of the case, told the ref he was cashing it in right now, and I guess the new rule is the ref waits until the champion is conscious, and then he rings the bell. And
that was never the case before.
It was what?
That was never the case before.
Not really, no. I think they might have done it one time.
You're allowed to change the rules, I guess, when things as things go.
Yeah, as he was waiting for him to get up, out came R-Truth and distracted Miz, so Miz took the case back. And the rules are now that until the bell rings, it's not official. So Miz still has his money in the bank, and I guess he's saving it for a rainier day.
I thought that segment was great.
Yeah.
You know, because it builds up the fact that it can happen at any time. Obviously, I don't think they want to. I think they want this one to last a while. And, build up a lot of steam. And, Miz was really, really good. The way he complained about it was good. I really enjoyed that segment. So, anyway.
Which led to Orton meeting with Sheamus and telling him he had a target on his back. And I thought, well, I'd rather see Miz, but this will be fine for now.
Yeah.
Regal and Zack Ryder against Kozlov and Santino. Just your basic death spot match. They did some goofiness. Santino begged for a tag after Vladimir killed Zack. Santino pinned him, and they were happy. No angle, nothing. So there you go. We had Wade Barrett against Mark Henry. This was the first major singles match for Wade Barrett here, I guess, in this program. Against, of all people, Mark Henry. It was not really very good.
They didn't give him any help, did they?
No. Henry, of all the people, I mean, for crying out loud. Henry went up to the middle rope, was going for a splash. Nexus came out on the ramp. The rules were that they could not interfere, so they didn't. They just came out on the ramp. Henry was distracted. Barrett gave him, I guess, his finisher. It was extremely sloppy. Got the pin. And
that finisher on Henry isn't very easy.
No.
When he started, I thought that he was going to drop him really bad.
Well, he kind of did, actually. Not really bad, yeah. But it was a mess.
Breaking his shoulder bad, the way he was starting to fall. But I guess he turned out okay.
It was also...
It looked ugly, though.
Didn't help that it was so close to the ropes, either. That's what worried me, but he didn't land on him, so...
How's he going to... Without the ropes, I don't know that he was going to be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had to climb onto the ropes to get him in position. But he slammed him so close to the ropes that I thought, God, he might get tangled in the ropes. He might hit his neck on the ropes. Could have been a disaster, but he missed the rope. So there you go.
Yeah.
Then we had the main event, which was them calling out Cena. And everybody knows the story by now. Cena came out, and he first said he wanted the truce. And they told him no. And so he hung his head in shame. And Wade said, I want you to join us. I want you to be a part of the Nexus. He said, think of all the things you've done in your career by yourself. If you were part of our group, you could achieve 10 times as much. And Cena declined the offer. And so Wade said, well, you can either walk out of here like a coward, or we'll give you the beating of a lifetime. And so Cena chose to walk out like a coward. But of course, nobody even bought this, that he was actually walking out like a coward. And of course he didn't. He got to the top of the stage, came back down and said, ever since you guys showed up, I've slowly been amassing a team. And this team is going to beat you up at SummerSlam. And of course it was Cena, Edge, Morrison, Truth, Great Khali, Jericho. And the final member of the team was in fact Bret Hart. And all the babyfaces, or at least the WWE team, hit the ring. The Nexus ran for their lives. And that was the end of that. So it feels, when it was over, it felt like this is a much bigger main event than usual. But at the same time, we've got 4 weeks, and historically, I don't know about this next 4 weeks building this matchup.
Well, they got to keep them separated, which they will for the most. Or they, I don't know. They better. They, you know, the thing is with this one, you've got. I mean, the thing with the 7-on-7 is you can hide a lot of guys, and in this match, there's many guys that probably need to be hidden. In the build-up, I think that they got to be pretty careful, you know, as far as like what they expose and what they don't expose. I mean, Barrett, you know, I'm glad that the match with Henry was short, because as that match was going on, you know, you really started to get the feeling that, you know, Barrett in the ring was not what he is on the mic. But perhaps with somebody else, you know, he'll look better. But I've never
really seen
Barrett look great in the ring. He's looked passable. You know, his mic work's impeccable, but some of the guys there on that team, you know, I mean, we know Otunga and Tarver, and those guys aren't particularly, you know, ready by any means.
They suck.
Sheffield's passable at best. Gabriel can work pretty good, mm-hmm. you know. Slater's not too bad, actually, you know. So, but I mean, in and out and everything like that, there'll be a lot of heat. It'll be a SummerSlam main event. And it feels like something special. I think they got a little bit of momentum, you know. They had a very good pay-per-view last night, so.
You know, the problem with this thing is, for these guys to get better, I mean, they're doing a multiple man tag at SummerSlam. And so, you know, and in fact, they've got house show lineups. You know that leading up to this show, they're going to do, you know, 4-on-4 matches, probably multiple man matches at all the house shows. And that's all fine in the sense that it's good to work multiple man matches to build up and get practice for your multiple man match at the pay-per-view. But at the same time, those guys are not going to get any better working multiple man matches. They need...
even though they're working with good people. I mean, you know, Jericho's a good teacher, and Edge is good.
But that's all fine.
They're working with, you know, it's going to be Cena, Orton, Edge, and Jericho against four of them, with the other three probably in the corner in most of the cities, I'm thinking.
Yeah, but the problem is, that's all fine and good, but you're doing a multiple-man match where you're getting limited amount of time in the ring with all of these guys. The best way to do this would be to split this up on the road and have everybody work longer singles matches with these Jerichos and Edges and Ortons and that sort of thing. That's how these guys are going to improve.
Yeah, I think they don't want to do that on the house shows, though.
That's the place to do it, though.
Yeah, you're right. It is. You know what? They should probably mix it up. Like when they have a weekend, they should probably do a multiple man match, like say on Friday, and then maybe on Saturday, do a regular tag, and maybe Sunday, you know, have the guys do singles. That's probably the best answer.
They need to mix it up and mix and match
A lot of mix and match, so they get more, you know, experience. But you know, the thing with WWE is when they do the weekend, especially when it comes to the main events, I mean, they want that pattern show where every night you pretty much do the same thing and you end at the same point and it lasts, you know what I mean? They're not into, they'll switch around the prelims a little bit, but they really don't switch the main events that much anymore.
We've got the Jake Shields situation. Will he sign with UFC? He's going to be facing Martin Kampman as his first opponent.
Yeah, I mean, that name has been rumored for several days now, and I mean, it was a logical, in a lot of ways, I sort of sensed it was a logical name. It's a guy who's, you know, won a couple of fights. He's good. If Shields wins, it's a quality win, and it's not a lock. You know, I mean, the whole thing of with Shields is that we know that if you have a guy who can keep it standing, he will beat Shields. And Martin Kampman is a good striker. He's got good takedown defense. It's not awesome or impeccable, so it's kind of an interesting match, and maybe it'll even be a good match. I don't know. That'd be, you know, rare for Shields, but you know, that whole division is going to get real interesting. You know, but the real key fight though is you know, Fitch and Alves in Oakland. I don't know if Fitch wins. He's got to get the title match because he has too many wins. I mean, even, you know, allowing for the fact that people probably don't want to see St. Pierre and Fitch, at some point, you know, you just have to succumb to wins and losses. But they may put Shields ahead of him. I think they'd be more interested in a Shields fight just because, you know, St. Pierre, you know, like a lot of times people complain about rematches in UFC after it's a great match. And generally speaking, when there's a rematch in UFC, business goes up, not down. However, I don't think that anyone who saw the St. Pierre Fitch match came out of it going like, I can't wait for this rematch. So they may go with Shields first. If Alves wins, I think just because it's been so little time since St. Pierre and Alves, and again, that was another fight where St. Pierre won five straight rounds. You know, it wasn't really close. He out-wrestled him and out-struck him. So at that point, I think if Alves wins and Shields wins, then Shields would probably get the shot, provided that St. Pierre beats Koscheck. If what I think is interesting is if Fitch wins and Koscheck wins and actually gets the upset over St. Pierre, as surprising as that might be, then what happens?
I don't know.
You know, I mean, Dana's been wanting to make Koscheck and Fitch for, you know, a year, and they've completely refused.
I was going to say, is there anyone else in the world besides Dana that would want to see it? Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't.
But Koscheck and Fitch? Yeah. You know, it's probably not. It's
not high on my list of dream matches.
You know what? I have actually, you know, I have actually seen Koscheck and Fitch, and it's not boring. Put it that way. So I mean, they go at each other in the gym all the time. Which is so crazy because Dana like mentioned that, and it was the craziest interplay because it was when Fitch won his last fight and he was basically asking for a title shot, and Dana was just like, you know, well, why don't you fight, you know, Koscheck? And Fitch just goes, I will only fight, you know, Josh, you know, with the gym doors locked inside the gym, and then Dana just comes back, that'll make a lot of money.
Yeah,
it was really awesome.
It's totally different, though, you know, going at it with a guy
training. I'm not trying to say that's the same thing as a real fight. I'm not trying to say that. I'm just saying when I did see it, it wasn't boring.
Well, sure, but that doesn't mean that when they actually went in there and they had to go at it and punch each other, it would be the same sort of fight. It could be vastly different.
They go pretty hard, but I mean, it's not 100%.
Yeah.
And you're right. Of course, it's not the same thing. But, you know, I mean, that's a lot of ifs anyway, But, you know, Shields is probably, you know, going to be right in the mix. Got three guys from this area, you know, because, you know, Shields is trained with those guys, too.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a regular part of the team, and they will fight him, you know. But it'd be interesting if you got, you know, those three guys all in the mix with St. Pierre. So, anyway, that's, you know, it's a good opponent for him for the first fight.
Let's go to the mailbag. This person here says, in a recent Observer, Dave wrote, Flair then talked about how the 86-87 Four Horsemen were better than all of them. Arn was better than Styles. Well, at promos he was. He says, I'm a little confused. Does Dave actually think AJ Styles is a better worker than Arn Anderson? That blows my mind. Certainly AJ has a lot of talent, some excellent matches under his belt, has a lot of hot moves, but the guy is nowhere close to Arn in terms of psychology, selling, storytelling, nuances, getting something over to where it meant something. There isn't any guy in TNA today who has the overall working ability of Arn Anderson in his prime. What does Brian think of this? I respect you both.
I would tell you as a fact that Flair would not agree with that because Flair said that Flair's told me many times that Kurt's the best guy in the business, and you know that and Kurt's one of the best guys that he's ever seen. When it comes to having consistently great matches, you know, Kurt's better than Arn Anderson. I mean, a lot of people are going to argue that one, but, I mean, Arn was really good, you know, really, really good, but Arn wasn't a guy who was, like, out there having four-star matches every night. I mean, when he was on a big show, sure, you know, and I mean, not that he was a slouch or anything, but, you know, I mean, if you watched every single Arn Anderson television match, and granted, a lot of them are squashes and everything, they weren't, like, the consistent kind of matches that you're going to see a lot of the top guys have now. And you're also talking about two different eras. If you're judging AJ Styles based on the standards of 1986 against Arn Anderson in 1986, of course the guy who wrestles in 1986 will have a better 1986 match, just as the guy who wrestles in 2010 will have a better 2010 match. It's a different business and different, you know, different fan expectations and everything like that. But the point that I was making is more I was making a joke out of the fact that Ric Flair is bringing these new guys in, and TNA's trying to get something over, and Ric Flair's out there going, like, none of you guys are as good as the guys from before. And even if that's the truth, and it is the truth, okay? I mean, I as far as the big picture goes, you know, is Beer Money better than Tully and Arn or whatever? You know, I wouldn't say they were at all, not by any means. But the point is that Ric Flair should not be saying that on TNA television in 2010. That's just ridiculous. So anyway, that was more my point than who is the better worker. I mean, as far as AJ is a better 2010 worker, Arn Anderson's a better 1986 worker. You put what Arn Anderson did in 1986, moved to 2010, and people would say it was too slow. But if Arn Anderson was wrestling in 2010, he would probably have a different style than in 1986 anyway. So maybe he would be better. Who's to say?
I think it is completely apples and oranges. It's if you look, one of the things I always notice when I watch WWE 24/7 is when you watch, like, even the job guys, those guys had fundamentals and a way of working that blows almost everyone out of the water today. Were they better workers? If you took Mulkey and put him in the ring in 2010, would he be considered like one of the all-time greats or one of the best workers in the world? Of course not. But, you know, I like the 80s, early 90s style of working, the Southern style. I love that style of working. I love those guys. But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that some of those guys were better than AJ Styles today. It's just a completely different, you know, AJ Styles in 2010.
A lot of those guys, if you look at it, and Arn's a perfect example. When Arn Anderson went to WWF with Tully Blanchard, to me, they were, you know, they were head and shoulders above almost anyone that was there.
Sure.
But to people in WWF, they were not. I mean, they were, you know, they were like, I mean, I remember that those guys there were, you know, God, these guys are overrated and this and that, you know, and I thought they're better than you guys. But, you know, again, because WWF and WCW had a different style. And a lot of people who were in, and you know, another example on this one is 2001 when WCW folded. I mean, with DDP, I mean, it's like, when
yes.
DDP went to WWF, all I heard over and over is, this guy is the shits, he's horrible, he's this and he's that. And I would talk to people who work with DDP and go like, is he really this bad? And it's like, well, everything's planned out ahead. And I go, but I saw him have great matches in WCW. I'm not saying he was an all-time great, but he was not. I saw him in too many good matches to say he was the shits. And their thing was is that, like, I think that there was, like, a certain cadence. You know, like, in you're supposed to bump on the third punch instead of the second punch or something like that, which no fan would ever notice and no fan would ever care about. But to them, it's like it's wrong, so therefore you're the shits. And, you know, the way that those guys were taught in the power plant, they were taught a certain way in the power plant, and the way the WWF wanted guys working was different, so therefore all of those guys that came in, and you know, remember Palumbo and O'Hare and all those guys, you know, that probably, had WCW survived, probably would have all developed into good athletic wrestlers and maybe even good workers. When they went to WWF, they were so far behind the eight ball, and they couldn't adapt because they were trained from the start in a certain way, and you know, they pretty much, their careers went nowhere.
Everybody listening to this right now has a style of wrestling that is their favorite. And when they hear people, and this is with anybody, when you hear someone saying that somebody that has a different style of wrestling is better than your favorite guy in your style of wrestling, there's going to be that feeling that they don't know what they're talking about, or that guy can't work, or it's an unfair comparison or whatever. And, you know, it's just like, you know, there are a lot of lucha matches that are fucking great. And you show some of those lucha matches to a guy that has never watched lucha or doesn't understand lucha, and he's not going to have any understanding. He's going to think you're an idiot. He's going to think you're a fool for liking this kind of match. It doesn't make sense to him. It's just, you know.
Well, that happened. That used to happen all the time.
Oh, yeah. So comparing workers and this and that,
science. Well, I'll give you an example on that one. Is in the 80s when Lucha Libre started on television, when the Arena Mexico matches started on television up here, when I first started watching them, and there were like, I had friends, Kurt Brown is for example, who's a really good friend of mine, and he was a big, big Lucha fan because he had gone to see the style, and it was in L.A., and he'd gone to Tijuana and places like that. And he would tell me about, like, these guys, you know, that he would see and how awesome they were. And I would watch, and, you know, their high-flying was, from day one, I mean, their high-flying was really good. There's no denying, you know, that. But, I mean, as far as, like, the work, I just thought it was, like, absolutely horrible because, you know, I wasn't used to it.
You grew up watching Roy Shire.
What?
You grew up watching Roy Shire.
Well, it's not even Roy Shire, because I grew up watching, I watched, you know, many, many different, you know, I mean, I watched WWF, and I watched Florida, and I watched Georgia, and all that. But the point is, but I didn't watch, and we saw some Mexican, you know, I mean, I saw Lucha Libre guys, or Mexican stars, you know, as a kid here, but the point is that they worked our style, and they used the acrobatics, and they adapted, and they ended up, and a lot of them were very good workers, but they did work the style that I was used to. But the point is, when I'd watch them do their own, you know, the Lucha Libre, you know, the Arena Mexico style that I'd never seen before. At first, I mean, it was like, well, these guys are shitty workers, but they are fun to watch. Their high spots are fun to watch. Well, you know, when I started watching it week after week, pretty soon, you know, all those guys that I thought were shitty, especially some of those, you know, the really good heels, they became awesome after a while. It's you know, you just kind of get used to the, you know, you get used to it after a while, and you kind of understand what they're trying to do as opposed to what you think they should be doing based on your own, you know, vision of what wrestling should be. And the point is, you know, I mean, every area had it, you know, at a different side. That's why I used to like the territory so much. It's like, you know, like Calgary wrestling was completely different from everything else. It was kind of like a mix of Japan, Europe, and American style. And I always really got a kick. I used to think that, like, the old Calgary stuff was some of the best wrestling there was, but a lot of people go, like, oh, what is he seeing that Calgary stuff, you know? You know, it's because if you've only seen one style, the Calgary style was different from the style you probably saw, and it wasn't as impressive. But, you know, a lot of those guys ended up, you know, a lot of those guys that started there ended up being some of the all-time greats.
This person says, is it true that if the 1989 movie No Holds Barred had been a success, the idea for the main event at WrestleMania 6 was to have been Hulk Hogan versus Zeus?
I think that even if it had nothing to do with the movie being a success, I think it had to do with if Zeus was a success. But that was very much the idea, but what happened was that Zeus was the shits, and they cut bait after they did that December pay-per-view where they did the tag match, and they were going to originally, you know, build that to the singles match with Hogan and Zeus, but I think they had no confidence in Zeus being able to work a singles match, so they just had him get, they blew it off in the tag match in December instead.
This person here says, after Raw, maybe you guys can give a smart answer to this. What is the point of building up DiBiase versus Morrison and Truth versus Miz if they aren't even going to be the matches at SummerSlam? Wouldn't it have made better sense to have added the Hart Dynasty, Kofi Kingston, or Evan Bourne to the 7-on-7 match instead, since they'd actually been beat up by the Nexus? That just really hurt the depth of the pay-per-view.
Well, Kofi's on the other brand. Evan Bourne, yeah, you can.
Evan Bourne should have replaced the Great Khali.
What?
Great Khali.
Yeah, I wish they picked Evan Bourne instead of Khali.
Yes.
Because, again, you know, Evan Bourne should be a guy who's you know, they started to do something with him, and you know, ever since, you know, this has been, you know, your classic Kofi Kingston push. You know what I mean? Where a guy starts to get over, and then you just keep beating him and put him back to where he was. And I never understand. It's one of those things about WWE that completely perplexes me. But I mean, as far as, you know, yeah, you can do it. But I mean, like I said, those angles were probably for television. I don't see Morrison, honestly. Morrison and DiBiase, I don't see a SummerSlam match, so I don't think they're really hurting anything. I think that Morrison and DiBiase, to me, is just two guys that are kind of like, they're both there. I don't know. DiBiase is a single.
Yeah.
It's not working. You know, even with Maurice, it's an addition to his act, but there's something missing with him.
He's incredibly bland in every conceivable way.
Yeah,
he's a generic worker with a generic look
and Cody.
Generic haircut, generic promos. I mean, he is a generic professional wrestler. That's not what we need in this business.
He's a good worker, but you know, the other problem is that he is doing his father's gimmick that his father did 10 times better.
Yeah, but he's...
I think that's a real bad one.
When you say he's a good wrestler, yes. I'm sure that I would love to have a match with Ted DiBiase, but Ted DiBiase does not go in there and blow people away with his matches. He's a solid wrestler that never screws anything up. He's always in the right place at the right time. But, I mean, what does Ted DiBiase bring in his matches that lights the world on fire?
Nothing. He was one of their chosen ones and, you know, got some breaks. And now that they put him on his own and he's not really making it, they're kind of lost at what to do with him. And then Morrison's another guy who I think there's a lot of people who like Morrison because he's very athletic. He's very good with the press. He's kind of over to a certain degree, but his promos are just I don't want to say they're a killer.
They're a killer.
At times they're a killer.
They're a killer.
He chokes at the wrong time on promos, I think.
His promos make him look like a complete geek.
Yeah, well, that's not good when you're a babyface. That's a lot better when you're a heel.
Remember that? I'll never forget this. Years back on SmackDown, him and The Miz did a sit-down interview where they buried each other. And it was clearly unscripted, and it was awesome. They were both so great. And I just sat there going, wow, you let Morrison, you know, bury a guy or cut a promo on The Miz, and he's great. And then, of course, it was right back to the stupid scripted promos, which he cannot deliver and which are always horribly written.
Yeah, he's not good with comedy on scripted promos. But you know what else? I've seen him, I remember on times where he hasn't been scripted, and I've seen him choke on time when he hasn't been scripted as well. And I think that may be one of the reasons why they, you know, force him to do a script, whereas some guys, you know, I don't know that, I mean, they script everyone out pretty much anyway. But I think that, like, a guy like Miz right now, my sense is that Miz is getting a lot of leeway just because there's a lot of stuff in his promos. You can tell what the writers write, and like Jericho and Miz do not do promos like other people in the company. And I don't think that that's because the writer that they're starting to get a lot of leeway. I mean, obviously Orton does as well. Edge, you know, those guys. But Morrison, I don't think that they trust because I think that they're afraid that if he goes on his own, you never know what you're going to get.
And finally here, this person...
But anyway, the point is that when we started all this, is I don't see Morrison and DiBiase in a SummerSlam match anyway. Miz and Truth, possibly. I sure hope that Miz has a match at SummerSlam, but he might just do the thing, you know, where he, you know, just does the Money in the Bank thing at the end. I mean, Miz has got to be, he's got to be a part of that show in some form, and I don't think that he should have been in that team, and he's not in that team, so that's a good point.
And finally here, this person says, I always wondered about Mr. JR, a manager in the dying days of Georgia Championship Wrestling. Who was he? Did he do anything else in the business, etc.?
God, I remember him, but he didn't do anything else notable in the business, that's for sure.
Well, that answers
that
question.
And I barely remember him. That was, I think that was, I don't remember him being anything, I don't remember much about him.
Well, everybody, on Wednesday, we've got a special show planned. It's going to be Dave and I and Court Bauer, who is a former WWE creative writer. He very heavily follows MMA. He was at the UFC event with Lesnar and Carwin a couple of weeks back. We're going to talk about that. If you've got any questions on WWE creative from probably about 2003 to 2008... Court Bauer would be the guy to ask, and we'll have a thread open on the board where you can put your questions in there for him. That is coming up on Wednesday. Of course, a new issue of the Figure Four out tomorrow, new issue of the Observer out on Wednesday, and a lot of big things coming up. So check out the front page for more, and we'll talk to you again after a while.